going to be seamless about all this. Understood?
Okay, I'm on it right away.
Okay, good. Gotta go. Hey, you are killing it. Fist bump.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 226 for the week of November 12th, 2018. I am tiny speck of mental wellness in a giant swamp, David T. Cole, and I'm here with pine cobbler recipe, Sarah D. Bunting.
The secret ingredient is conspiracy.
Protected bird, Tara Ariano. And forgetful pasta enjoyer, Mark Lazanti.
Pasta was good. Or was it?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Grape. Before we get into the meat of it, yes, it's happening again. The feed is changing. Now, if everything happens the way it should make absolutely no difference to you. But if you're 2 weeks from now, you're like, where the hell is my new episode of Extra Hot Grape? That means we screwed up somewhere, and you should go to our site, www.extrahotgrape.com, and get the new feed information. But like I said, it worked flawlessly last time. I'm hoping for the same results this time, but an abundance of caution, I'm letting you know the feed is changing. All right, with that, let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the podcast, and welcome to our guest, Mark Lazanti. Hi, Mark.
Hey.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, guys.
Or as I always call you in my mind, Mark Lazanti.
Hey,
hello, Mark Lazowski.
Like,
I don't know why I do that. I just do.
We are here to talk about Amazon's homecoming. And let us, I'm going to throw this open to the group. I've been dubious about half hour dramas before, but man, I love a half hour drama. Homecoming has convinced me. Mark, what are your thoughts on the runtime of the show?
So good.
Yeah.
So good. You get through it quick. It's not, you know, it's not the Romanoffs, which I'll talk about later. An hour and a half per.
Yeah,
you whip through this whole thing in like 5 hours.
And it's none of that half hour where like sometimes it's 40 minutes. Like they're all pretty much exactly a half an hour. And I appreciate that economy of storytelling. So Homecoming is Amazon's new series. It's famously Julia Roberts' basically TV debut, certainly her prestige TV debut. Of course, hat tip, I would be remiss since Sarah is here to not mention her infamous episode of Law and Order, famous original, in which she screws over Ray, at the time her real life boyfriend.
Yeah, she's
what's
so
his name?
Goddamn
Benjamin Bratt.
Good in that episode. Oh my god.
Oh man, so hateful. But here, yeah, she is not hateful. She's playing Heidi Bergman, who's a social worker who's like a project counselor for a program called Homecoming, which is meant to help integrate returning combat veterans back into, you know, civilian life. And then it turns out, maybe not so much. Mark, what are your high level thoughts about what worked on the show and what didn't for you?
I'll tell you, the atmosphere and the directing are pretty amazing. Sam Esmail of Mr. Robot fame, which for me was a real mixed bag of a show.
Yeah.
That I did not stick with through the second season.
Same.
But this one I think has none of the problems that show had. Partly driven by what you mentioned earlier, the nice, short, tight episodes, you know, like seems to be a really good choice to have adapted this material in this way. It looks amazing. There's a little camera trickery that maybe we'll talk about later that seems like a gimmick at first, but then actually serves a narrative purpose. And that was a pretty amazing reveal. And it's great, you know, the actors. It's a very small cast for the principals, Julia Roberts and Bobby Cannavale and Stephen James. And, you know, that's basically it for the main people, right? And then
Shea Whigham,
too. Yeah, so the fourth one, you know, and Alex Karpovsky and Sissy Spacek on the smaller end of the roles. But, you know, it really worked and it really zips along. And the sound design on it is amazing. You know, which is something that they apparently carried over from the podcast. It really works. It was a good watch.
It's been a good year for TV shows with like 70 direction throwback. Like between this and Maniac, I kind of feel like, you know, we're going back in time, because this was a very like I'll explain where I came into it. Tara had watched the whole series prior to me watching it. And I had only like come into the room on two or three scenes, and all the scenes I came into made me think this was something totally different than it was. Like the scenes, I won't bother with what the scenes were, but it kind of felt like I was like, it was a rom-com or not a rom-com, but a coming of age story or something like that, just based on the scenes. So I came into it knowing nothing, and it turned out to be this weird sort of military Chinatown, all the president's men vibe. Yeah. Mystery, and I had no idea it was a podcast. Like I knew nothing about this, and I was sort of like, oh, I gotta watch this stupid show, it's gonna be so boring and vivid. And it turned to be like very engrossing, very interesting, and as Mark said, like the direction and the you know, the set design and the color grading and everything was excellent, and it really kind of put me in the mind of those movies I mentioned a lot.
Yeah, the Sam Esmail factor was like a potential, it could have been a stopper for me, because I didn't realize going into it before I watched the screeners that it was him, because I also bailed on Mr. Robot after the season one. But and considering that the subject matter, as Dave said, it's like it's also has, you know, sort of conspiracy elements, could have shaded in that direction. And there certainly were lots of opportunity, if they hadn't hewn close to the source material, for them to like go wild with like what is real and what is not. But it was satisfyingly nothing like all of those elements that turned me off Mr. Robot. Sarah, what were your thoughts, since I think you watched more of Mr. Robot than I did?
I did. Apparently there was a third season. I still haven't watched it yet, but I was a lot more forgiving because I liked a lot of the ways it was built. What it was to look at and the many references within it kept me entertained, even when on a straightforward narrative level, I didn't know what the fuck was going on, which was a big problem. And also Christian Slater, like smaller doses, I would say. Like the All the President's Men reference is explicit. It's in episode 9. The soundtrack is from All the President's Men. And before that, I think in episode 3, you have a cue from Chariots of Fire. I have not looked up all the references like on IMDb. I'm sure someone has written this.
I think AV Vulture Club had a post about, all of the soundtracks that it borrows from.
I put my phone basically like after the Vangelis one, I put my phone like between the couch cushions, because I was like, I want to be able to spot these for myself. But when they're referring to, like when there's a Hitchcock reference, it comes from the music. And like, I think that's from Vertigo, or I think that's from The Birds, appropriately. So I thought that was really cool. I guess it could be seen as gimmicky, but you know, Alan J. Pakula, who did All the President's Men and The Parallax View, which if you guys have never watched that, is so good. Like their recreation of that kind of just like muddy brown film stock 70s conspiracy, like Dave said, was really good, but then not overplayed.
Yeah.
And this is a perfect format. Like we sat down to just watch a couple episodes with dinner the other night. And, you know, if Dan was like, this is bullshit, then I just watched the rest of it myself. But we watched the whole thing in one night and went to it like 2 a.m. because it's half an hour and you just want to keep going and you want to see if it goes where you think it's going to go, which at the end it kind of doesn't. And that sort of like banality of evil explanation of the dates on the paperwork, for instance, is like, oh, like, is that it?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just a really enjoyable, contained, focused set of episodes. And man, like a half hour sort of drama thriller that isn't beholden to TV commercial act breaks. Mm-hmm. It is the future, and also apparently kind of the past. Now, let me ask you guys this, because once Dan, my husband, pointed it out, I couldn't stop thinking about it, even though I didn't necessarily agree. We took a break between episodes 8 and 9, and he's like, if I were writing this and I were directing this as a play, I would stop the story right there. Mm. Even though you don't know, like, you sort of know the outcomes, but not really, like, you don't know what becomes of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
What does everyone else think of that?
Because that's the episode that ends. So she's just figured out that, or been told basically by her boss, Colin, Heidi, we're speaking of, has been told by her boss that this isn't actually a program to reintegrate veterans into civilian life. It's to erase their memories so that they can be sent back in and redeployed. And so this is shattering. It changes her whole perspective on everything. And that episode ends, if I recall correctly, with her like staggering back to her office and like gathering all of her desktop tchotchkes into her arms
and crying
to sort of soothe herself and crying. And yeah, so that's in the homecoming timeline. What we haven't talked about yet, and Mark mentioned this, sort of glanced at this and we can get back into it, is that this proceeds on two timelines. There's the 2018 timeline where Heidi is working at homecoming, and then 4 years in the future when Shea Whigham's character, Thomas Carrasco, who works at the Inspector General's office at the Department of Defense, is investigating a claim from that time. It's taken this long for it to get to anyone, investigating what was actually going on there. And so, Mark, do you want to talk about a little bit about visually how they represent this?
When they're flashing forward to the 2022-ish, right? Something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The very near future. The aspect ratio on the show changes. It changes from a widescreen to a box to like more of a square. The way that old televisions used to look. It's crazy.
It's actually an even like slightly narrower than that, which is even more even destabilizing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a portrait. And versus landscape, it's mm-hmm. very weird.
It's an Instagram portrait size.
So it feels very cramped and it feels very claustrophobic. And that obviously sets the tone for those scenes. As we know that something has happened with her, that she's now not, obviously a counselor at homecoming anymore. And now she is a waitress and seems to have no recollection of her time as a counselor. That could have been an easy gimmick, just like a just useless visual flourish, a bit of fussiness. But he uses it to, it's an easy marker to keep track of the timelines, but it wouldn't have been that hard to keep track of the timelines anyway, mm-hmm. because there's different haircuts and whatever. And Shea Whigham's plot line is entirely in that future. But
which looks like Brazil. A lot of the time, and Zodiac actually.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been that confusing to keep it straight without that. So they didn't need it solely as just a marker to keep your place in time. But do we want to jump ahead to what it ultimately means when the letterboxing comes back in?
Sure.
Does anybody want to take that?
She's gotten this piece of evidence from Carrasco that gives her the address of where homecoming is. So she goes there. And meanwhile, she's called Colin because she has no remembrance of who he is. She's just innocently calling to try and figure out who he is because she's found this old cell phone of hers from that time. And so he goes to Tampa and is like just testing to see whether she really does remember him or not. She definitely doesn't. So they have a whole like weird, deceptive relationship, and he drives her there. They walk through, and it's a great, I can see Dan's point in that it's such a great climax, because at the same time we have Carrasco walking through the homecoming half of this building, this weird office park where homecoming was, and then on a exactly parallel, because it's called Mirror Pond and the two sides of the building mirror each other, she's walking through what the Geist Corporation has turned it into, which is this bullshitty wellness center. I love the detail that went into building this place where it's like a therapeutic oils. Like, of course it is, like, but she's, none of this is familiar to her, obviously, because it's not, it's she doesn't remember legitimately, and it's not what was there at the time.
But there's that like deja vu, like trace signature in her memory somehow. Like she remembers it, but not quite. And then the fact that the corporation's name is Geist, which auf Deutsch means ghost. I just thought that was cool.
Oh, I thought that Willy Geist had wronged them somehow. And they were paying him back. Some Espiola.
I mean, Mira Pond. Hello. Just kidding.
But yeah, she does find her way back to her old office. And so she's, you know, he's Shea Whigham's on this, or what would have been her old office on the opposite side. And so he has sort of, it looks like he's given up, and he's looks through the window, and then he sees her. And at the same time she stands, and there's this endangered bird, and it makes this, it's weird cry. And that brings her, that triggers everything. And then she remembers it. It's an amazing shot. I've actually made a GIF of it for that story that I wrote for Slate that I talked about last week, where the frame widens out into, you know, widescreen.
Yeah. And she's like receding at the same time. Right. It's amazing. It's like utterly cool shot.
Yeah. I forget what they call that shot, but it's like they dolly towards the actor while focus pulling.
Yeah. I can imagine ending on episode 8. I mean, the 9 and 10 are like fine, but you're right. Like they don't flesh out more than what we could have probably put together on our own, except for the scene of them eating the dosed gnocchi together. But I feel
you wouldn't want to miss that.
I guess
that was important.
Gnocchi looked dry as hell.
Well, in episode 10 seemed, I think episode 9 and episode 10 could have been one 30-minute episode.
That's true.
It went on for a while. Like, we get it. She's driving to fish camp. Like, stop split screening. Like, that felt a little indulgent. And like, Esmail was like, look, I played by your earth rules, and now pants around for this finale. Like, all right.
I agree. The rest of it felt pretty much fat free to me. I mean, I also could have lost the scene between Heidi and Walter's mother, which I thought was a little like, I don't necessarily need to see her go and make amends. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand, like, you want, if you have Marianne Jean-Baptiste, you want to get her as many scenes as possible.
But of course, yeah.
I don't know.
Spoiler-free painting a picture on the craftful restraint of Homecoming. So we have inspired 70s throwbacks. We have aspect ratio sort of changes. We have timeline jumping. And we have borrowing soundtracks from other stuff. Quentin Tarantino could have been, but it's not. It's this.
Yeah.
The borrowings are a lot less obscure than Tarantino.
True.
I kind of agree that 9 and 10, you could have changed that, either dispense with it or shortened it. But like, the guy's already talking about season 2. So I guess this is a story that's going to continue somehow, question mark.
That was something I was going to say about if they had ended at the end of 8, when she has the realization and going to that sets up the second season in a very different way than the end does. And it seems that what they're choosing to do at the end, to flash forward for a second, is to start a whole new story in the second one around the new drug treatment. But if they had cut it off in 8, I think you have to reckon with what happened to Heidi, what happened to Walter. Right, I don't know if season 2, they're coming back for season 2. Did they announce if it's the same characters or it's just the same world?
I haven't seen. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, should we talk about the ending?
Sure.
Is there, you know, it seems from my Twitter timeline like there's some disagreement as to the meaning of the last scenes. I didn't feel like that was ambiguous. Once we saw,
like, Inception, you could compare it to Inception, right?
Yeah.
Pen versus the spinning top.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess if you want to, you know, this seemed a lot less ambiguous than Inception was. Like, I thought it was very clearly pointing in one direction.
Yeah. Same.
But you could read it. I mean, I guess you could read it either way.
Okay, well, why don't we just like describe what actually happens? This is a post credit scene mostly.
Oh, when I was talking about that, I was talking about the pen and the diner.
Oh, yeah, the Walter. Oh, okay, the Walter and Heidi scene. Sorry.
Yeah, I have no idea what the end post credits meant.
Okay. I was talking the real end, not the
not the fake extra end.
You know what? I couldn't remember which was the post credits and which was the real end anymore.
When everybody at Geist Corporation's eating shawarma. Yeah, that was really weird.
Okay. Well, the roller, I mean, so Jen Chaney, I think, at Vulture had a post about it, which was like the fan theory is that Audrey is Mr. Geist. And I had read that post when I was watching through with Dave the second time. And the first time we do see her character, she's sitting behind a desk that like this enormous reception desk that says Geist right in front of it. So like if she's secretly been Geist all along, like maybe that was a hint that and there's also like the phrasing, the way that Colin says it, like you'll take that into account, won't you? --, Mr. Geist. So I don't know if we're going to get to know more about like what her character's deal actually is in season two, if she's been part of like some kind of psyop on him, it, you know, given everything else they're doing, I suppose it's not outside of the realm of possibility. So what the ending you guys are talking about.
And I keep referring it to it as the pen, but what I mean is
it's a fork, right? Yeah.
It's a fork.
Yeah, the fork.
So Heidi is like me, very particular about everything on her desk being lined up, and that's totally normal. And I don't think there's anything strange about that, or that it says anything else about her character. Cough. In their office, she always has to have the pen on her desk lined up, you know, parallel to the edge of her desk. And every time Walter comes in, he like turns it slightly. So when she finds her way back to Fish Camp, as Sarah said earlier, where he has left post homecoming and is building a deck or whatever. And so she sits in a diner and he happens to come in and she's, you know, very weird and breathy about him, but she doesn't tell him who she is. And they have this very pleasant exchange. And at the end of it, he leaves. And then when he's gone, she looks and sees that he's turned her fork at a 45 degree angle the way he used to do with her pen.
Yeah, I thought it went on a little too long, given that she clearly was not going to like show her cards.
Yeah.
Which I think was, you know, true to the character, but it was like, okay, let's move it along. But once she looks down and sees the fork, then it makes a little more sense the way he was not only willing to engage in the conversation, but willing to continue it as long as he did. I don't know. I think it was a little bit ambiguous as to whether he recognized her.
Right.
But I think he did. I think we're supposed to understand that he did, even though he may not know from where, but that's where that sort of, ghost like scent signature whatever comes in again, that he may not consciously recognize her, but something like there's some trace.
Yeah, that was my take memory on it too. Yeah.
Mark, oh, so you're reading that as potentially him moving the fork is just his, you know, his character trait to do that, rather than him signaling, I know and this is me and maybe potential let's meet up later.
I think he doesn't know he's necessarily signaling that. Like, he could be conscious of it and recognize her and know who she is. But he also could have just moved the fork for, like, Pavlovian reasons that he doesn't remember.
Right.
That he's not conscious of. And I'm fine with it either way.
Yeah, my read on that was that, I mean, the other thing that was sort of hanging over this once we figure out what it is they're trying to do in terms of memory is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And yes. So my read on the end of that final scene too, is that this is similar to in Eternal Sunshine, is that even if you erase people from each other's memories, like their essential nature, if they are in some way, like not soulmates or whatever, but like if they're
simpatico,
if there's some kind of destiny about the way that they'll interact with each other, like they'll find their way to each other. And that's just how they are. It's so similar to what Sarah said.
Right.
Their essential natures are reaching out to each other in the same way that they did at homecoming.
Okay. Yeah, I was reading it more as like, this is a signal from me, you know, and you can come follow me out later and we can talk again.
So the answer to some of our questions that we brought up, the final scene says Sam Esmail is a a kind of choose your own adventure, intentionally left that way. So he's not saying one way or the other. Amazon has picked this up for season two. They are in the writing room right now. The only thing he said about it is he does point to the second, to the season finale post-credit scene that we're talking about with the bingo dabber of forgetfulness as a hint of things to come in season two. So sounds like it's like product testing is over and now we're going to market with season two, right, or something like that, you know? So dollars to donuts, it doesn't involve Julia Roberts' character. This is just sort of like elsewhere in this world that is
that felt like the
semi-anthology. Sure,
yeah. You know, elsewhere in the Rambaldi adjacent universe, this happened, you know.
So. Right.
But if we can get a spinoff with Sissy Spacek and Shea Whigham, like, fixing record players, so just
that
hanging
scene was
out,
cute.
That was very cute.
I love this kind of rumpled Shea Whigham dogged detective business. He's in everything, and this was, you know, I like him in everything. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed the way they used him here and kind of got more to do than he does in a lot of other stuff.
And I think we all can agree that even if you bailed on Mr. Robot and like have a prejudice against Sam Esmail products for that reason, you can and probably will like this. We can give it our seal of approval. I know Adam Grossworth, at least past guest of the show, when was surprised to hear me say that I liked it for that reason. So, yes, even if you soured on Mr. Robot, give it a shot.
Before we go around the dial, we have a message from Leisha. Leisha writes, "Happiest 12th anniversary to you, my dearest Chai Ninja. Some of my best memories are of the long road trips you and I took between Minneapolis and Chicago, binging on Mark 1 Extra Hot Great, munching on baby carrots, and trying not to drive each other crazy. I feel this podcast has been with us for a large portion of our relationship and has definitely added to our couple's lexicon. To wit, I think you mean the Ohio State University, through methods, and various Sarah D. Buntingisms like yard sale, chicken fried fox, and so many more. Aside, I totally forgot about chicken fried fox. Thank you so much, Leisha, for reinstituting that. Returning to her their message, I love you more than I could ever say, and I hope for many more years of happiness and life with you. I hope you enjoy the melodious tones of our favorite Sarah's lovely voice. Wishing you a very happy, very queer 12-year anniversary. Love, your pants."
Aw.
Aw.
Was that love, your pants?
Love, comma, your pants.
Pants is a nickname.
Love that. Okay.
It's not literally from pants.
Oh,
no.
Okay. Tari Ariano, we're starting around the dial with you. Go.
Okay. I want to talk to you about two comedy shows about and by women in their 40s. Let us start with Baroness Von Sketch Show. This is a Canadian show I'd never heard of. Until it came on IFC, we watched, I think the first two seasons aired like very quickly back to back on that show and on that network, rather. We watched them. We enjoyed them. It made me very homesick for Toronto. If you've ever spent any time there, the opening credits will tug at your heartstrings, if for no other reason than that one white squirrel from Trinity Bellwoods Park makes an appearance in the credits.
Oh, the albino squirrel.
What I love about the show is not just that it's a sketch show from the perspective of women who perform and write it, but also that it's women in their 40s, very specifically. Dave, can you please play the first clip? Here's an example of a sketch from season 3.
Here's something a little special. This is a preserving agent. If you have a leftover half bottle, you just spray it inside and it will keep it fresh for up to 10 days.
Okay. Well, where do I get that?
Oh, you can buy it right here. $12.99.
No. I mean the half bottle of wine. Where do I get that?
Oh, well, if you've had part of a bottle of wine, say one or two glasses, but you can't finish it.
I'm sorry, I don't follow.
Well, if you're on your own or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can't drink the whole bottle.
Why?
Because it's just you.
just me. Exactly. Okay. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Sorry. Just walk me through this. Okay. We'll start at the beginning. So I have this bottle of wine.
Yes.
And I drink it.
Well, in this case, as I mentioned, you don't drink all of it. Some of the wine remains in the bottle.
Oh, I'm so sorry. No. Oh, I get it.
It's okay.
Yes. So I have this bottle of wine and I don't drink all of it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right away. I wait until the stupid kids have gone to bed and then I get my husband out of the house. I have him walk the dog or something stupid like that. I put on Showgirls. And then, of course, when the kids come downstairs because they've woken up, I take this can and I spray it all over the room to make them think that they're dreaming. And then I send them back upstairs to go to bed and then I drink more wine.
That's it. You know what? How about I just sell you a second bottle?
Okay.
And we'll call it a day.
All right. Well, sell me a case and we'll call it a week.
It's right over the corner there. Yep.
I was never here.
So I love, first of all, how this sketch features both of them saying I'm sorry to each other. Very, very Canadian. When I was scrolling through this episode to get this clip, there's a lot of sketches with people apologizing to each other at the beginning and or end. The other clip that I cut for this also describes sort of the tiredness that one experiences as a woman in her 40s. This is a little bit shorter. Play clip two, please, Dave.
What is that one?
Well, this is our Platinum Cruiser package. For $700, you can get in my friend Dan's car that's parked right over there, and he will drive you to your home. It's the best package we have.
Wait a minute. So if I pay more than them, I can go home, sleep in my own bed, and no one will barf near me?
Yes, that's correct. And it includes 3 original photos that you can post on social media, so it makes it look like you were here the whole time.
Sold.
Come on,
sucks to be you, bitches.
There you go.
Okay, well, we can just go find a dry patch of grass for the tent.
I guess so. Does this pass come with Lyme disease?
Oh, Lyme disease is extra.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I should have said that's at a music festival. That would have set it up better. The joke in a lot of these sketches is the gulf between the person that you wish you were or want to be and who you actually are. There's another sketch in that episode with 2 women out at dinner, and when they're settling the check, the waitress comes back and asks, you know, what they're doing next, and they both crack up for a whole minute at the idea that they would do anything next because it's 8 o'clock. Anyway, if you enjoy sketch comedy, check it out. Even Dave likes it, or at least has passively been in the room while it's been on.
I'll tell you, I think I was like 50-50 on the first 2 seasons. Not that we only watched 1 or 2 episodes of season 3. Seems like season 3 has a little more bite to it. But I have to say that first clip you played is like really wine o'clock adjacent. Like, I don't think
that's
a very strong indicator of what this show, how funny the show could be, because that was like kind of cringeworthy. But there's lots of good stuff in the show. Well, okay. I'm telling you, ladies talking about not finishing wine and that kind of stuff, it's you know, come on.
Fair enough. If you are a woman in your 40s, your mileage may vary. Speaking of, the other big premiere this week was on HBO, paired with Camping, which I was a little down on when I first talked about it when it premiered a few weeks ago, but now it's really grown on me. So if you checked out of Camping, check back in. It's really getting good. This is an import from Britain called Sally Forever, and it stars Julia Davis, who is not really a breakout star over here, but I guess I gather has done a shitload of stuff in Britain. She seems like this year's Catherine McKinnon, that woman who was on The Office at the end, that redheaded woman who she came into it acting like we were all supposed to know who she was and that it was a really big deal that she did it, but no one in America knew who she was. Anyway, this one revolves around this woman, Sally, who has a very unhappy life. It's really miserable. She's in this relationship with this guy who's one of the bald weirdos from the Thick of It universe and is a total loser. And she's like stagnating in this relationship. She's been living with him for ages, but he keeps proposing and she keeps saying no. Finally, they have a really awkward moment and he proposes again and she accepts. But then when we see them in bed, we get a sense of why she's been saying no all this time. Cause play clip 3.
I'm gonna have a Becky.
could have smoked a goose.
I think I'm fine. I'm good for that.
Sure.
Thank you.
But fuck.
It's water.
Yeah. Oh. You've got jam in it.
They're jammy dodgers, that's why.
Do you want to make love?
No. Thank you.
You have to watch it to get all of the incredibly disgusted expressions on Catherine Shepherd's face as this guy keeps coming on to her and she is not into it at all. The show does a good job in the first episode of establishing why this particular character would just like drift through and just go along with his proposal, even though she cannot stand him. And clearly the sight of him like makes her skin crawl. She does a good job of portraying this kind of doormatty character who would just rather like say yes to get on with life. But the first episode also dares you to not watch with a lot of body horror. She ends up meeting this woman, Emma, who comes on to her really hard. And though it seems like this is the first time, they end up having sex and it's super graphic. But before that, we also get her fiance trying again to have sex with her. She says no. She suggests that he could go jerk off. He asks if she wants to. He says, could you watch? Her answer is, do you mind if I don't? Which feels like the British equivalent of like all the I'm sorry's from Baroness von Sketch. Anyway, then we get a scene of him jerking off. Please play clip 4.
Actor, oh my God.
Okay, so two things. One,
is that
I was
even
watching
better when you can see it?
Yes, it's amazing.
Sola.
this is Dave. This is the dad from the Inbetweeners that the joke was that he's gay. It's that guy.
Okay, yeah.
So I was watching this on Sunday night. Murray was in bed. She was dead asleep. She woke up to this sound, very curious about what it was because it sounded like an ape, which is very amusing to me. This actor is, if you look him up, Alex McQueen. He's a British. Hey, it's that guy that you've probably seen a million times. But his commitment to being so gross and loathsome is like amazing. So the first few minutes of this, I was like, I don't know. And then it really won me over. So that's Sally Forever on HBO Sunday nights. Check it out. For my plug, nothing for me this week. So I'm going to mention our friend and former coworker, Zach Hug, has been writing Hallmark movies, not just Hallmark movies, you guys, fucking Countdown to Christmas movies. So you can already check out Road to Christmas, which premiered 2 weeks ago. And this Sunday, November 18th at 8 p.m. ET, he wrote Christmas in Evergreen, Letters to Santa. Zach is a delight. I know people love Hallmark movies, and this is like part of the Christmas season for many people. So please hold Zach Hug in your heart and check out his Hallmark movies.
All right, Mark, what do you got for us?
I've got a couple of Around the Dials, a couple of shows on Amazon. Highly anticipated follow-up to Mad Men by Matthew Weiner called The Romanovs, which has been a real mixed bag. apparently after him shopping it all around Hollywood, Amazon finally just opened up the floodgates of money, gave him complete creative control. He responded by just making a kind of like giant mess so far. What are we about 5 episodes in? Is anyone else watching it, trying to keep up?
No.
I think we're about, no. It's an anthology show that's loosely based around the Romanov family of Russia. And each episode is, you know, characters that have some kind of connection to that. Sometimes you don't know whether or not they're really a Romanovs. They all believe themselves to be, or represent themselves that way. And really the biggest disaster so far is 2 weeks ago's episode that had Andrew Rannells and Diane Lane in an episode where, for some reason, Matthew Weiner thought it would be a good idea to tackle a story of a man who is perhaps falsely accused of sexual misconduct.
Oh, good. This who better? Is,
this is a problem that he has in his own life that arose after Mad Men was off the air with one of the writers on the show and him. He stood accused of, what did he say exactly to her? Does anyone have this at the tip of their head? He said,
he owed it to her. She owed it to him to let him see her naked.
You owe it to me to let me see you naked. And
that's what the money's for.
So there's an episode that deals with that and very clumsily. I think I had read a good Steppenwolf piece dealing with what a disaster this was.
I read the same one and was, I enjoyed the scathing secondhand. I'm never going to watch that shit.
Yeah, I was. It's a huge letdown because Mad Men is, you know, one of the greatest shows of all time, one of my favorite shows of all time. It had an incredible mastery of tone. You know, it was a drama that was extremely funny. It could switch between these tones very well. And it feels like now that he was released from, you know, all the constraints that AMC had put on him. You know, he was always fighting with them over episode length and budget and stuff. Amazon seemed to have given him no oversight whatsoever and just let him do whatever he wanted. And so far, it's just, you know, it's a big mess. Some of the episodes are pretty good to very good, and some of them are just weird and terrible. On the other side of the Amazon spectrum is something that is incredibly underhyped, and I think nobody really even knows it exists, and it's just released its second season. It's a show called Patriot. It is incredible. It is one of my favorite shows of the last couple of years. I think that the first season ran last year. Season two was released last week. I'm about halfway through the second season. It's a show I've become like the crazy person about. Like when anybody asks for a recommendation, what should I be watching? You have to watch Patriot. But at the same time, I know that half the people that I recommend it to are going to absolutely hate it because it's it really walks this incredible high wire of tone. It's very dark. It's, you know, it's really a comedy, but it's shot like a drama. So that throws people off. I think immediately they're expecting one thing and getting something that's like sort of a Coen Brothers-esque kind of dark comedy.
Okay.
But maybe even more deadpan. It's extremely deadpan. It's a story of kind of like a CIA black ops family with Terry O'Quinn as like the patriarch and
Patriot. His name's Patriot.
Mr. Patriot. Michael Dorman, his name is. I'm sorry.
So you're like the fourth person to bring up this show on Around the Dial, and like kind of like who they're all saying the same thing, which is like this is an underappreciated show that like has a tone that you're going to like love it or leave it, but if you love it, it's like singular on TV right now.
You become mildly obsessed.
Yeah, past guest of the show Jeb Lund is like in love with it. It's his favorite show.
It might be my favorite show on right now. It's
wow. We should give it another shot. We watched the premiere and then kind of bailed on it.
But I watched two last. I watched season, I think episode 3 and 4 of season 2 last night, and I will say this: episode 3 is one of the best episodes of television I have ever seen.
Holy shit!
It is incredible. See, one of the quirks of this show, and this is going to either make you say, "Wow, that sounds really interesting," or say, "This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard," is that the main character is his alias is John Lakeman. Has a habit of singing folk songs as a release from the darkness of his job as like a, you know, an off the books assassin type. And he sings very, here's the word deadpan again, but that's like the number one word that describes a show, very deadpan song about, of what he's going through. And then the third episode, there's a song that, plays underneath a really insane and sort of borderline disturbing bit of physical comedy and darkness. It's so good. If any of this sounded even remotely appealing to you, check it out. But here's the thing, like, you know, it's like a show you recommend to people and then you spend 10 minutes like I am rambling about, like, but you might not like it. You're either going to love it or you're going to be like, you're a total idiot. You have no idea what good things are and you have no sense of taste.
Well, you're certainly in good company when it comes to recommending it. And like Tara said, like, we need to give this another shot because this is like, it's getting ridiculous how many people have pitched this to us on the show and we haven't watched the full first season yet. So it sounds like shades of The Long Kiss Goodnight with Samuel Jackson singing his way through murdering people. All right. Well, this we promise. Me and Tara will give another shot and we will also report back soon on Patriot season 1 and 2.
Indeed.
All right.
Yep. All right.
Sarah Dibadig.
Here's a show that's not good. Real Housewives of New Jersey. Still watching it though. Not only am I still watching it, I realized 2/3 of season 8 was still sitting on my DVR as of last week. So I watched all of that shit over the weekend to get caught up to the season 9 premiere.
Yeah.
Really do not recommend that. That is a lot of Danielle Staub's uncanny valley face. She's not even credits cast. Anyway, if you were thinking of bailing on the show because of Siggy Flicker from last season, she is out. But a couple of caveats. There are 2 new housewives this season. So if, like me, you hate change, especially in Real Housewives franchises, but more ridiculous place to resist change. But anyway, if you have a difficult time adjusting to the newbies, look out for that. And if also like me, you have a difficult time not wanting to find Teresa Giudice and kick her in the tits, it looks like her whole namaste whatever is in for a backslide this season, at least when it comes to playing her brother off her sister-in-law in a cringy way that is like inappropriately competitive for a sibling relationship. So business as usual. Plus, I think we're going to have to see her auditioning thongs for her Bonkaloo competitive bodybuilding outfits.
Oh, God.
Which is going to be super upsetting. We didn't do this in Union County, so I don't know what's going on. Everything's the worst. Hold me. If you're also still watching this, I'll see you on Twitter. For my plug... related. I have a podcast with my esteemed colleague and owner of the Blankenship Chair, Mark Blankenship. It's called Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. And that podcast has an auxiliary podcast in which Dan Rogge and Tracy Potocnik reimagine the vanity singles of Real Housewives as folk songs. Their versions are actually quite beautiful. The originals are a thing that occurred. We have not yet contemplated Danielle Staub's Real Close, but next month, Money Can't Buy You podcast will be addressing that very song and Dan and Tracy's reimagining of same. So you can subscribe to Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs wherever fine podcasts are not sold. And those Money Can't Buy You podcast episodes will just pop up in the same feed. So if you're looking for a folk version of Danielle Staub's Real Close, and Who Among Us, etc. Subscribe to Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs.
All right. So before I get into my show, hot off the presses, Tara, your butt buddy, Pedro Pascal, is in fact the lead in that Star Wars series, The Mandalorian.
Yeah. So, congratulations to me. Winner of the week.
Ooh. Well, and congratulations to me. Now you have a reason to watch the Star Wars show.
So I probably watched it together.
So yay. I am back this week with another Dave Forcening, courtesy of Brennan Brezzo, a frequent Game Time contributor. Before I tell you what it is about, perhaps we can let the show tell you what it is not about.
This is not about the A-Team, or Charles in Charge, or Webster, or Small Wonder, or Silver Spoons, or Out of This World, or Magnum P.I., or MacGyver, or Perfect Strangers, or Facts of Life, or Happy Days, or Who's the Boss, or Head of the Class, or Too Close for Comfort, or Knight Rider, or Dukes of Hazzard, or Greatest American Hero.
This is Oil Drums, an episode from season 2 of the cartoon Teen Titans Go, which is a follow-up season to just Teen Titans without going. I guess the original one was sort of an action one, and this is more about their home life and kind of more of a comedy. It's sort of like, all the characters living under the same roof sitcom, but it's a cartoon about DC superheroes. So you got Robin, you got Cyborg, somebody named Raven, Beast Boy, and maybe somebody else I can't remember. I've never watched this before. I have heard about it before. I have to say that this episode was really funny, and it's cute. Pretty obvious why Brennan picked it. It's all about the importance of watching TV.
Without TV, I don't know what to do with myself.
It's just TV, Cyborg.
Just TV? The best moments of my life have been sitting in front of that guy. He teaches me life lessons, made me laugh, and filled lots of empty time.
Wow. You sound like a crazy person. I think we should use this opportunity to take a break from TV.
What? Why would we want to do that?
Because concerned parents have theorized for decades that TV rots the brain.
Well, that's obviously ridiculous. TV keeps your brain active, healthy, and strong.
So there's the premise of the show. The episode picks up when Cyborg, who, you know, is the Cyborg guy. You may remember him from actual movies like Justice League, if you saw that. I did not. Cyborg declares he's got the three letters to solve the group's boredom, and those are VHS. In his own words, he's got VHS for days. Teen Robin immediately makes a viewing suggestion upon hearing this. It was one of my favorite parts of the episode. You're not going to see the crazy, like, crooked teeth animation during this, but it's manic enough that you get the gist.
Let's watch Alf again. I love Alf. Yes, eat that cat, Alf. Eat him. He's hiding in the kitchen drawer, Alf, but be patient. Savor the hunt, you beast.
So, you know, this is a kid's show. It's pretty dark and weird and awesome for a kid's show. The problem is they want to watch VHS tapes of 80s shows, but they can't find the remote anywhere. Cyborg goes through the couch cushions. He's finding all this weird shit, including a gold prospector named Sticky Joe, who lives down there. It's just this weird, crazy, what the fuck moment that's like right up my alley. So with no way to operate the TV, the Teen Titan gang brainstorms on ways to kill time. And on this point, I heartily agree with them.
We just have to do whatever people did for fun before TV.
Like a parade?
Oh, I've heard of those.
This a parade?
It's just people walking.
True. So as their time without TV lengthens, Cyborg makes a terrible olfactory discovery.
This is bad. Ugh, your brains, they're rotting.
But we haven't been watching TV.
Exactly. Just as I suspected, TV keeps your brain from rotting by feeding it information in good times.
So the episode never, ever lets go of the flip conceit that TV is the thing that keeps your brain from rotting. And it's all the outdoorsy stuff that your mom and pop want you to do that's really actually to blame. It never actually lets go of that in the credits, in the post credits, or anything. And I really appreciate that. So the issue comes to a head when, without the positive effects of TV, the Teen Titans' brains, except for Cyborg, who has been watching more TV than anybody else, so he's a little more resistant, their brains completely rot, and we get clip 5 here.
Your brains! They've completely rotted!
Mm-hmm. It's so nice out.
Ah! Let's go for a hike.
Join us for a game of miniature golf, brah.
I'm taking a French class.
Zutalos.
Your rotted brains are making you crazy! No, no! I don't want to do activities! You can't make me! TV, what are you doing here?
So that's old man TV flies into the house. He kind of looks like a TV with like Ned Flanders' face on it. Really weird. He breaks down the front door, and then he takes Cyborg into like various 80s TV shows to locate the missing remote, which they bring back and finally turn on the TV, saving the rest of the Teen Titans.
Thanks for fixing our brains, TV.
No problem. So I was thinking, it's such a beautiful day. Why don't we all go on a hike? Or perhaps take in some culture at a museum? I'm just messing with you. Let's watch 18 Hours of A-Team!
And that's how the episode ends. It really exceeded my expectations.
Like
I was prepared. Well, first of all, it's the A-Team. So like the fact that they... Well, first of all, real shows mentioned on another show. That's really rare, especially mm-hmm. for a kid's show, that yep. they pegged it to the A-Team, you know, speaks to me personally. But the tone is sort of like Dexter's Lab meets Clone High, and the animation is very similar to both of those, you know, very crisp, like Powerpuff Girls or a show like that. And the voice work is obviously very energetic, as you can hear. I'm always sort of wary of doing kid's shows on Extra Hot Great because, like, so much of it is, you know, just for kids. And then, like, God bless you if you like it, but I always feel like I'm the guy like YA novel shaming people if it's not up to my standards. Like, you watch that? That's a kid's show, you know?
Can I make a confession about this and it being a kid's show?
Yeah.
I have let my 4-year-old watch it for a small amount of time. It happened to be on TV once. We put it on and he probably watched about 4 episodes in a row. They were pretty short. Most of it went over his head, but he was having a good time with it generally.
Aw, that's good.
Yeah, and I think like that kind
fun
of show
for the whole family, even though it's explicitly not for 4-year-olds.
Yeah, and that kind of show is rare where you can actually, you know, it works on different levels for the kid, you know, for the 4-year-old, for the 10-year-old, and then for the 35-year-old watching. Like, that's pretty rare. And most of the shows just work, you know, at that 5-year-old level, and you're bored shitless if you have to watch it with, you know, your niece or nephew or son or daughter. But this was actually like generally funny. And of course, you know, for a TV minded podcast and, you know, people on this, it hopefully speaks to them. I was just surprised that this show was this funny. The episode is called Oil Drums because they're explaining that the A-Team usually foils people by making stuff out of, I don't know, you know, like oil drums and stuff. Really funny stuff. I'm glad I watched it. This is was a revelation. If you have watched the entirety of this series, I would love to hear about other episodes that are on this level. Because there is a lot of them out there already. David@cole.fyi. I would appreciate some tips on that. All right, it's time. We finally figured out how to do it. Minis have been gone for a while. We kept on saying we were going to do mini-only episodes when we're going to miss shows. Problem is, we haven't been missing shows. We haven't had to fill in gaps. So we thought, why not have them on the main show? So without further ado, we are now introducing the extra credit segment. And nice. Tara, you want to take it from here?
Sure. This extra credit is called American Royalty. Corey writes, pick one American TV actor to marry into British nobility a la Meghan Markle and AJ Langer. If you don't know about AJ Langer, Google it. What is their new title and pet cause? Which of their co-stars will come to the wedding? And adds, elaborate as you like, pip, pip. Thank you for the Britishism. I will go first. There aren't that many young royals to marry off anymore, but I found one from the British royal family to marry. So the eligible royal is Princess Beatrice of York. This is Prince Andrew's daughter, sure. Not the one who just got married, her sister. And for her, I have paired her with Michael Vartan. Here's why. This is a guy we know from much of his TV work has no problem taking a backseat to a female partner who outshines him in every way. Do I think he's a dreamboat? Yes. Has he aged since Alias? No. He's totally hot. But he does not seem like he's the type to be threatened if, you know, his partner kind of eclipses him with whatever she's got going on. And, you know, she's a princess, so that's going to happen. For his title, I couldn't find a list of like available dukedoms. So I went with Duke of Vaughan, Ontario, just because that is a real place. It is in the Commonwealth. And that was his name on Alias. Co-stars who would attend, probably not Jennifer Garner, since he dated her on Alias and they are not still together. And therefore probably not Victor Garber either, because he is like her surrogate father IRL now. But since he co-starred with Bradley Cooper on the short-lived Kitchen Confidential, maybe the two of them have that going on still, plus their, you know, French-speaking brodom. And I can also imagine Josh Henderson and Autumn Reeser being fame-hoary enough to want to come over, even though they only did 2 seasons of The Arrangement with him. Pet cause, I'm going to say foreign language education, because as I already mentioned, my dude is French. Mark.
I am going to select as my American TV actor. I did not do the research to find him an open slot in the
fair
family.
Enough.
Somebody else will have to find this person his royal mate. But I'm going with Jake Johnson from New Girl.
Love it.
Yeah, right?
yes.
I did not also research real titles. We'll just make him Earl of Slackerfordshire. And his pet cause will be improving British beer.
Yep. Excellent.
Yeah. I think the whole gang shows up.
For sure.
To the wedding, Schmidt and Winston and Jess. And then Coach shows up only at the very end.
Yep.
Sarah. All right, Sarah.
That's a good, solid New Girl joke for all the New Girl fans out there.
Indeed. That's for the real heads.
No idea what I'm talking about.
I am sending Jenna Dewan into the heart of the British aristocracy. She will be marrying Gregory Mostyn, the 7th Baron Mostyn. And I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that name because based on his land holdings, he appears to be Welsh. So it's probably actually pronounced Tom Jones, but anywho. Jenna will continue her animal rights activism and will attempt to infuse the British food scene with decent vegan options. A challenge to be sure, but I believe in her and her very pretty hair. Her Witches of East End co-stars will both attend the wedding and film the reunion movie, Witches of West Cross, that all four of the show's fans have been clamoring for.
Love it.
Dave.
All right, so since Nick Offerman and Ron Swanson are basically the same people, I sort of conflated them here, but that's who I'm sending over. He falls in love with Princess Tammany III, and he becomes the Earl of Sandwich. Why? Because he will not leave any thread of meat on the floor of your clean car. As he says, I leave no meat behind. It's an honor thing. Now, if that's not royalty, I don't know what is. He has no causes because everybody should be self-efficient, but secretly teaches British children how to make canoes in his royal woodworking shop. And that is extra credit. And that is the canon. This week, Mark Lazanti is presenting. Take it away, Mark.
I am presenting episode 13, season 2 of 30 Rock, Succession. 30 Rock is universally agreed upon by any human being whose sense of humor is to be trusted. It's one of the best sitcoms of all time. Perhaps the best. That would be an argument for another day. But let's not fight that right now. One only has to look at the Extra Hot Great canon itself, where four episodes of the NBC comedy have already been enshrined for tautological proof of 30 Rock's worthiness. But today I'm here to add a fifth entry to the Pantheon. And quite frankly, I'm shocked. Shocked, I say, that my nominee has not already found his place of glory, as worthy as the other inductees are. We'll call it an oversight, and one we hope to rectify in the coming minutes. And so here's humbly submitted Succession, episode 13 of 30 Rock's second season. It's 21 minutes, follow two tracks of story. The first involves Jack Donaghy's attempts to wrest control of General Electric from the scheming hands of Devin Banks, the treacherous son-in-law-to-be of retiring chairman Don Geis. As part of the plan for succession, hey, there's the title, Jack's decided to elevate feckless confidant Liz Lemon into his vacating position of head of East Coast television and microwave programming. Complications ensue as Liz tries to ingratiate herself into the old boys' club of the company, mostly by drinking herself into upwardly immobile oblivion. Along the way, Don Geis falls into a diabetic coma at an inopportune moment. Banks schemes his way into power behind feral flower-eating fiancée Kathy Geis, and Liz decides she's not executive material. There, you have your near-perfect A story. But the B story? Well, it's an all-timer, and it's our main concern today, so let's dive in. While Jack and Liz are off dealing with their succession-related issues, we check in with TGS star and proud father Tracy Jordan, who's humiliated when he discovers his son Tracy Jr. was too embarrassed by his old man to let him participate in Bring Your Dad to School Day. Tracy, having already worked through his feelings in the moment in his trademark shirtless way, resolves to do something important to earn his son's respect. He quickly rejects the standard pathways to paternal regard. Senator, wizard, Oprah-like patron of an African school. Still, he realizes he needs to do something that will change the world. After a frustrating brainstorming session with Kenneth the Page, he decides to clean his mind palate. Here's clip one.
Then after you carbonate it, you drink it.
It sounds like soda pop.
Damn it! Why is leaving your children a legacy that'll live forever so hard? It's been almost half an hour.
Maybe we should take a break, Mr. Jordan.
Yeah. I need to clear my thought sickles. Which one of my two favorite pastimes shall I indulge in? Video games or pornography? That's it! Make a porn video game!
Having now smashed the unlikely peanut butter of erotic filmmaking into the unexpected chocolate of gaming, Tracy takes the Reese's of a sudden inspiration to the only logical person he can, TGS's resident dirtbag, Frank. Frank's skeptical. This is his area of expertise, after all, and he's studied it thoroughly. Charts are involved, as is a trip to the filthy Uncanny Valley, where virtual abominations do their nasty business. Here's clip two.
A porn video game? It can't be done. Look, Trey, history's greatest perverts have tried. Walt Disney, Larry Flint, the Japanese, but they can't do it because of the Uncanny Valley.
Let me show you something. Check out this chart.
You see, as artificial representations of humans become more and more realistic, they reach a point where they stop being endearing and become creepy.
Tell it to me in Star Wars.
All right. We like R2-D2 and C-3PO.
They're nice.
And up here, we have a real person, like Han Solo.
He acts like he doesn't care, but he does.
But down here, we have a CGI stormtrooper or Tom Hanks in the Polar Express.
I'm scared. Get me out of there.
And that's the problem. You're in the valley now. And it's impossible to get out.
That's where you're wrong. I was born to design a video game where characters get weird with each other for golden points. My genius will not be denied. I'm like Mozart. You're like that guy that was always jealous of Mozart.
Salieri?
No, thank you. I already ate. You will not deter me. The world is going to remember the name Tracy Jordan.
Will this Mozart versus Salieri reference just be one of the throwaway lines nobody does better than 30 Rock? Or will we descend deeper into a fever dream homage to 1985 Best Picture winner Amadeus? Probably already know the answer. And if you didn't, maybe you'd get a hint at our next shot of Tracy in the throes of creation, furiously scribbling notes as a classical score begins to swell. Here's clip three.
I've never seen you like this, Mr. Jordan. This project is consuming me.
No, for the first time in my life, I know my purpose. I'm doing this for my children. My genius has come alive, like toys when your back is turned. I see the potential for erotica in everything around me. This cup, this table, even you, Kenneth.
Well, I am wearing a cuffed trouser today.
Tracy, what are you doing? They need you in wardrobe.
I'm inventing a porn video game.
Let this man work. No one is to disturb him.
Don't hold your breath, Pete. It can't be done, or else I would have solved it a long time ago.
Yeah, maybe Frank would have. But Tracy was already far down the path to greatness, passed out on his couch among the balled-up detritus of inspiration. Cue the strings, and cue clip four.
Has he finished?
Not yet, but don't disturb him. He can't keep going like this. He was up for 6 hours straight. My God. He's a genius.
And now, upon Liz's discovery of an unconscious Don Geiss, an overlap in our two stories as a call goes out for qualified medical help. Or, to Dr. Spichemin. Kate billowing behind him as he rushes through the halls to Geiss's bedside, stopping only to coax a bag of mini pretzels from a nearby vending machine. Meanwhile, Frank's overmatched Salieri does his best to collect the lurid squeezings of his Mozart's preserved perverted mind grapes. It does not end well for him. Genius prevails. Ambition destroys its porn stash in a fit of thwarted rage. Clip 5.
Duet becomes a trio. Trio becomes a quartet. And on and on. Do you have it?
You go too fast.
Itself. What was Tracy's master stroke? We don't find out until season 3 premiere that our Amadeus of Interactive Nookie moved 61 million units of Gorgasm, The Legend of Dong Slayer. That episode has no fluttering capes, no parodically virtuosic nods to an Oscar-winning Milos Forman opus. It's no Succession. Back to the episode at hand. Here, right now, we're left like Frank, knee-deep in shredded girly mags and tangles of angrily unspooled VHS tape, screaming our own plea to the heavens. Put this in the canon!
I feel like we should start with Sarah, who does not watch the show as regularly as Dave and I do. And he and I can close it up. So, Sarah, go ahead.
You get one canon pitch in life. You've chosen well. This was outstanding. I had filled an entire page of my notebook with notes by minute, I'm going to say 8, just of quotes. Many of which were from the A-plot, but I thought it was really even more brilliant watching this Amadeus homage after discussing Homecoming and all the like music cues that I was finding that were familiar in that, and then having worked in 30 Rock and seeing this doctor in slow-mo and his like huge cape and wondering how many takes it took. Like, these hallways are not that long. Like, you know, how many takes did...
My favorite part of that scene is that when he opens up his medicine, his doctor's bag, like, there's a crumpled bill just gingerly sitting on top of everything. That, like, that's the way he packs his bag for some reason.
There's a single bill right there that he just takes out. It's not in a wallet. It's not anything. It's just there.
It's just, lofted there. This was great fun to watch. There were a million throwaway lines. The whole scene with Liz being business drunk at the table and being like, "You suck, Don." I mean, it was fantastic. And then that her business hair is like immediately collapsing, and the collapse continues evolving, and just Kathy in the background like eating a flower. Just so good. One of my canon criteria, as listeners know, is that is whether I want to just keep watching after the canonical episode has come to an end. And I certainly did. So yeah, excellent presentation. Very focused. You did it in one day, and I will turn it over to the rest of the panel.
Should I go first, Dave?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I think you did a great job on the porn plot line. The Tracy dancing with the banner with the shirt off, crying in the classroom, embarrassing the kids. I mean, it's great, and all the Amadeus references too, excellent. I feel like you gave slightly short shrift to the A plot, so I just want to talk a little bit about that. Dr. Spaceman, hilarious. All of the stuff that happens after Don Geiss's coma, where he's like, he shoots him up with a placebo because he thinks he might be faking. He can't give him a shot of adrenaline because no one knows where the human heart is. And then gets on the phone to call for diabetes repair. So good. I guess it's like one of my favorite Dr. Spaceman lines.
Does this episode also have the ew syringe moment? Yeah,
yes.
That's a running one with him. Yeah, I love that.
And all the stuff with Liz. I mean, I know in a short circuit, one of the moments that I know, I don't want to preempt one of the things I know Dave is going to mention because it's one of his favorites from this episode and from the series, which, by the way, when this canon submission came in, we've been rewatching 30 Rock for like the past week and a half. So we were just a little bit past this, but it was, of course, a pleasure to revisit it again. And I love business Liz. You know, how quickly she gets into the swing of, you know, throwing around trash talk over lunch and what bullshit it all is. And she just like can't believe this is really a job, like what they're getting away with for the little that they're doing. But also I like her interaction with Don, where he, you know, the premise of this episode is that she's about to be an executive and replace Jack. And he asks her to go and like calls her honey and asks her to go get him something to eat. And she just like rolls with it because, you know, it's not a big moment, but where she says, yes, but I want you to know I work for tips. And it's just like the tone of her voice. It's partly that she's drunk, but also partly like this is a man in his 70s. There's no point trying to educate him about, you know, who you are and how to treat people. Like, you just you just go along with it. But also the stuff with Devin and his, you know, sham engagement to Kathy, who, by the way, Sarah, I don't know if you realize that's Marceline Hugo, who's like very dignified as one of the guilty remnant in The Leftovers.
And she also had that whole sequence in Better Call Saul.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, yes, I did.
And then does this. Like, there's other episodes where she's like running up against a wall, like trying to break a door down and stuff. Like, this is a really, it's, if you've ever seen her do anything else, it's crazy that she's also Kathy. But anyway.
And the little wardrobe touches on Devin also, mm-hmm. like, it's just the right amount of that.
Yeah.
Like, his outfit at his bachelor party, which is like a lame V-neck.
I think it's actually a scoop neck. But yes, to just give a mention back to when we were talking about Seinfeld a couple of weeks ago with Eve, and she was asking, like, can we still enjoy the contest knowing what we know now about, you know, voyeurism and what's okay and so forth? And, you know, I don't think even she thought was that committed to it at the time. But I do think that Devin in the early seasons, like him being a closeted gay guy or not really like being fake straight for the Kathy storyline is like one of the things that hasn't aged super duper well. But I do think that the show kind of came back from it later by having him be like living a very happy out gay life and have a husband and be raising kids. And like, you know, I feel like they course corrected on Devin, but you know, at the time this was like, well, it wasn't really that long ago. It was 9 years ago, 10 years ago.
2007, this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of it does feel a little icky if you think about it too much. So I'm not going to, cause it's funny, Dave.
But that's sort of like Tina Fey projects. There's always something a little icky about it somewhere along the line, right?
It's, you know, like that is
she
true.
Has this weird blind spot sometimes. But
yeah, you know. We were watching one of the ones from season three that we were watching last night was where she's giving out advice as a deal breaker and tells a couple like, no, bisexuality isn't real. That's something they just made up to sell hair product. Probably not a line that would make it into a show. Right. Now,
no, her thing is always, if it's funny enough, it goes, you know,
it's true.
And
yes.
It doesn't really, she, that's one of, it is one of her blind spots that they don't seem to ever go past that.
True. Yeah. Dave.
Okay. So obviously the Mozart stuff is inspired and Mark did a great job laying it out. For me, the one single funniest thing about this episode is Business Liz, who has, by this point in the episode, committed to being Business Liz, has accepted this giant salary, has gone out, has started blaming Jorgensen for all things that go wrong. And she now has to fill her spot or at least bring somebody up with her. So she goes to Pete and says, no, I'm taking you up with me. And he's like, no, I can't do it. There's too much responsibility. I'm not a manager. And then she does the same thing that Jack did earlier. Jack shows her, gives her a piece of paper. This is the starting salary. And she just slaps him. She just can't contain her energy. Just slaps him. So when she does the same thing to Pete, of course, he slaps her. But she just turns around in perfect comedy timing and just mouths, I know. It is the funniest fucking thing on this episode. One of my favorite moments at 30 Rock. It cracks me up every time.
Yeah.
It's just like such a perfect little beat cherry on top of everything. The other moment that I really like watching this episode for like the umpteenth time is one of, I forget the exact line, but Liz basically just tells Jack to lighten up and, you know, does some line about, well, here's a tampon. And the act out is him just gingerly stuffing this tampon into the inside breast pocket of his suit. And he just kind of looks to the side a little bit, not embarrassingly, but this is just like, well, this is something, you know, I'll just put this in here. And that's just the commercial break. Just for some reason, just cracked me up.
There's so many moments like that of like tiny Alec Baldwin physical business on the show that like you could really have an excellent GIF library of that.
Yeah. And just that sort of not underlined, but still there commentary about how easily Liz can adapt to the casually sexist Business Liz version of herself.
Yeah.
She's like, what's the matter? You got your period? And it's like, yeah, Liz, you know, that's what you're surrounded by as Business Liz. So, yeah, it's a gooder.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with 30 Rock is like, I agree with Mark. It's like, it's my favorite sitcom. it's one like rewatch I can do every year and not get tired of it. Don't know like how many more 30 Rocks we could put in the canon before it gets ridiculous. I know we have like seven or eight Simpsons in the canon because that's how the canon started, but it's hard to say no to a 30 Rock, you know, if because they're pretty strong. And this one's one of the strongest. So I'm going to say yes when it comes time to voting, which is right now. So for me, yes. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
Tara Arrieta.
Yes.
All righty then.
I also vote yes. Oh.
All right, that means 30 Rock, Season 2, Episode 13, Succession. You hereby are inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
You loved it!
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Winner this week, Sarah, what do you got?
Jesse Pinkman, bitch. The Breaking Bad movie is happening. Vince Gilligan is attached. And apparently this is like not just going to happen. It's like happening right now. Like they're already in the desert getting set up to shoot this thing. So very exciting. And not least for our friend and esteemed colleague, Alan Sepinwall, who can now do Breaking Bad 102. Pamphlet attachment to his excellent book Breaking Bad 101.
And loser league,
I have a loser, Ice-T, who revealed last week that he's never eaten a bagel.
You know what's funny, he missed the cut for loser last week, right?
Oh yeah, because he got arrested for blowing through a toll booth or something. But yeah, he's also never had coffee. I don't think that's such a big deal because I haven't either. But yeah, never eaten a bagel. How do you live in New York?
He also misspelled bagel, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Oh yeah, he spelled it like bugle, right? Bagley. Yeah.
That's so weird. I mean, I guess I get it, but I don't know. He's like, he works and lives in New York, right?
Well, yeah. It's one of those things where, like, after enough time, it becomes a thing that you're, like, consciously doing to keep right. the streak going. Like, my sister-in-law, yes. who is now running out of rooms in which Star Wars is on, like, just fucking watch it already.
Eat a bagel, Iced Tea.
Yeah. Well,
weird hill,
you know,
to die on.
As soon as
time.
As soon as this came out, like, everyone started rushing their content of, like, what should Iced Tea's first bagel be? Without there having been any indication that, like, this is something he's agreed to do, but like bagels are good. Eat a bagel.
I unfollowed someone Bialy? For suggesting he eat a cinnamon raisin bagel first because that's bullshit.
I think if Ice-T went into the bagel shop, he would see the everything bagel and he would definitely go for that because it's got
I agree.
Everything on
Man,
it.
Man, they have those things on craft service tables.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have to go out of his way.
It's true. Nope.
Speaking about things with everything on it, do you know what time it is?
game time.
Now I'm just imagining that Ice-T skit with John Mulaney, except instead of about dead people, it's all about people explaining bagels to him. He just keeps on asking questions about bagels.
Bagels, easy pass.
All right, guys, this is the first game time of the new season. Today we are playing Letters from Philo from Raymond C., who earns himself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot, great extra credit mini topic. I don't know. What are we calling those now? I think we still call minis.
Extra credit topic.
Okay. Extra credit topic or Dave Forsening of his very choosing. All right. In this game, I am going to read you the log line of a show that's a result of a one letter change to the show's title.
Oh.
We're playing three rounds. First round, we change one letter. Second round, we add a letter. Final round, we subtract a letter.
Oh, boy.
Give me the title of this one letter off show for 2 points. Or ask for a hint, and I'll give you one of these star actors from the show, after which the answer is good for 1 point. Here is an example that I made up because I realized we didn't have an example. So don't blame Raymond for this one. Join a crew in a 5-year mission of exploring the galaxy to find new life forms to push knives into. Change one letter, you get the title of this show. Uh-oh. That is Stab Trek.
Oh, Stab Trek. Got it.
I was looking
Damn,
for extra or
well.
Fewer letters in the clue.
All right, guys. Well, this will be interesting. Before we start, let's get the steel mill situation from Tara Ariano. Please, steel mills.
Okay. Sarah D. Bunting has 9 steel meals. Valued guest, this time that would be you, Mark, have 3 steel meals. I have 0 steel meals. So, Mark, so you know, if another player misses an answer, you can jump in before Dave gives the correct answer and go, steel meal! But it would have to be after, I mean, after, I guess.
After points. They get it wrong.
If they get it wrong, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, can we guess and then still get the hint?
You either have to guess for 2 points or ask for the hint for 1 point. You don't get to double dip on this one. So with that in mind, let's throw it to the person in control choosing initiative, a.k.a. Picky, to see who is going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. We're going to go Sarah, and then we're going to go to Mark, and then Tara. Are we ready to play Letters from Philo?
Yes.
Here we go. Remember, round one, changing a letter.
Changing a letter, not adding a letter, which is what was in my mind for the example.
Changing. A widower tries to survive as a single parent while juggling allegiances to 3 crime families. Guess for 2, ask for a hint, and then we'll go to 1 point.
Juggling allegiances to 3 crime families.
A widower tries to survive as a single parent while juggling allegiances to 3 crime families.
I need a hint.
All right. Your actor, Fred McMurray. Yes. Fred.
They call him Fred.
I got it.
Oh, good for you. Because I don't. Okay.
Steel meal from Mark Lazanti right off the gate. Your guess.
My 3 dons. That's
my good. 3 dons. Nice.
Oh, why do I know who Fred McMurray is?
Everybody knows who Fred McMurray
is. I'm not.
Because when
old.
You got home from school, My 3 Sons was one of the shitty sitcoms that was on between 3:30 and 5 that you had to watch. Yeah.
I even know the theme song.
Good job, Mark.
All right, Mark, here is your actual question. In this reality series, abandoned lockers full of preserved food are sold to the highest bidder, hoping to flip them for a tidy profit. Guess for 2 points. You can ask for somebody from the show. I'll read it again for you. In this reality series, abandoned lockers of preserved food are sold to the highest bidder, hoping to flip them for a tidy profit. One letter has been changed from the real show to create this show.
I know the show, but I can't think of the change the letter. I'm going to kick myself.
Talk it out. What do you think the real show is?
Storage Wars.
We got preserved food. It's highest bidder.
Storage Jars?
2 points.
Oh my God. You gave me way too much time to do that.
Sarah D. Bunting.
No.
Do you want to get
Tara Ariano.
Yep. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Tara. A panel of improv comedians are asked to identify different types of sausage.
Whose link is it anyway?
Sarah D. Bunting. Every week, a challenger faces off against a master chef to see who can create the toughest jerky in 1 hour.
Against a master chef? The toughest jerky?
1 hour.
Damn it. Okay, I need a hint.
All right. Your hint is the chairman.
Oh. Okay. What would be the letter that I want to say iron beef, but that can't possibly be right because that's 2 letters that change. So
the toughest jerky.
Iron. I do not know. Someone steal mail it.
Anybody? All right. The answer is iron chew. Iron chew. All right.
That's nice.
Mr. Lazanti.
Nice work.
A male housekeeper looks for a guitarist to join his rock band. Give you a hint. You can go for broke. Answer it right now.
to me one more time.
A male housekeeper looks for a guitarist to join his rock band.
Who's the bass?
Correct. Well done.
I got the show, and it takes me a second to flip the letter.
I had the show, but no idea. Good job, Mark.
I'd quibble that a bass player and a guitarist are not the same thing.
Take it up with Raymond C. All right, here we go. This is for Tara. A pair of fascia consultants help average people overcome their phobias.
What not to fear.
What not to fear. 2 points. Sarah. Sergeant Pepper Anderson is an undercover officer who issues tickets for rude behavior.
Sergeant Pepper Anderson? I need a hint.
Angie Dickinson.
Rude behavior?
Yes. Do you know what
White
show
woman?
We're talking? Pardon me?
Polite woman?
Polite woman? Wow. Good for a point. Good job. All right, Mark. It's a shame Tara didn't get this one, but here we go. You'll cry tears of rage as the show profiles a handful of criminals whose blood alcohol content was off the charts when they were arrested.
Give me a hint, please.
Okay, your hint, John Walsh.
Oh. America's Most Wasted.
America's Most Wasted.
Thank God.
Oh, good. All right, Tara.
Yeah.
A young doctor tries to balance her professional and personal life as she is trying to find the perfect flavoring for gum, toothpaste, and chutney.
The Minty Project.
To Sarah. In the first episode of this competition series, a group of would-be chefs get yelled at by the jerky inventor of the telephone.
Bell's Kitchen?
To Mark.
The inventor.
A panel of celebrities tries to identify the fibers that came from a mystery guest's sweater.
God. Panel of celebrities try to guess the fibers from mystery guests.
Yeah, try to identify the fibers that came from a mystery guest's sweater.
I need a hint.
All right, your hint. John Charles Daly.
John Charles Daly.
This is an old one. Give you that hint.
It's real old.
Oh, man. Swatch game?
You steel meal.
Steel meal.
Hey.
What's my lint?
What's my lint from What's My Line? Correct. All right.
Nice
well
work.
Done. Good steel meal there. Tara?
Yep.
High school students in an honors program led by a creative teacher vie to engineer the perfect mollusk.
Oh.
High school students in an honors program led by a creative teacher vie to engineer the perfect mollusk.
I feel like I know the show, but I think I have the show wrong. Rather, go give me a hint.
Well, let's just hear it out before we get the hint. What do you think the show is?
Head of the Class.
Whoops, sorry, I didn't mean to press that. All right, your hint. You just said Head of the Class, by the way, over that buzz. Your hint,
yes,
Howard Hessman.
Great. Beat of the Class? I have no idea.
Steel meal.
Oh, Mark said it first.
Okay, Mark.
Head of the Clams.
Good for a point. Okay. Sorry about all the miscues there on my buzzers. All right. Back to Sarah. A family with 3 boys and 3 girls who all fail to make the starting lineup.
The Brady Bench.
For Mark, the camaraderie of a team of beach lifeguards is upset when one of their members flies away on a broom.
A witch.
Tara Ariana.
Watch that.
Yes.
In this daytime syndicated show, people bring their small claims cases before a magistrate who finds the truth with the aid of Japanese martial arts.
Oh. Shit. I think it's the People's Court, but I don't know how that works with the... Okay, hint.
Judith
Scheindlin. Oh, Judge Judo.
Judge Judo. Good for a point. All right, Sarah.
Yeah.
After a near fatal accident, a woman is reconstructed with artificial body parts and devotes her life to making films about the lives of famous people. After a near fatal accident, a woman is reconstructed with artificial body parts and devotes her life to making films about the lives of famous people.
Famous people. Biopic woman? Oh my God.
All right, this is question 17.
Ready to go.
For Mark. A young woman moves to the Hamptons and calculates the amount of money received during the fiscal quarter of the company of the family who framed her father for treason.
God.
A young woman moves to the Hamptons and calculates the amount of money received during the fiscal quarter of the company of the family who framed her father for treason.
I can't think of the name of the show, but I know the show. I guess I don't know the show. I know it's that.
It's that one. That's that one with the thing.
The one with Emily Van Camp.
Yeah.
Someone steal it. Someone steal it.
All right. Anybody got that one?
I don't know steal the play.
Sarah. Well, I can't get a point for it, but is it revenue?
Revenue, correct.
Oh, I see.
All right.
Ray's being real stinker by not having these rhyme. He's really thought this through. Good job, Raymond.
All right, Tara.
Yep.
The crew of the Starship Enterprise is replaced by salamanders. She's giggling.
Yeah.
The crew of the Starship Enterprise is replaced by salamanders. You want the hint? You're going to guess?
I know it's Star Trek, but I'm scared it's one of the spinoffs, so hint.
All right. Your clue, Patrick Stewart.
Okay. Starch. Star Trek, The Newt Generation.
The Newt Generation. Okay. This is question 19. And it, of course, is for Sarah. The house mother at a boarding school guides her girls through adolescence by teaching them about the physics of flight. The house mother at a boarding school guides her girls through adolescence by teaching them about the physics of flight.
I hope this is right. The facts of lift?
Nice. Yeah. I know we were all hoping for the farts of life, but that's
excellent. All right, Mark. Ray. A fictionalized version of the creator of Seinfeld struggles to stay true to his Atkins diet.
Carb your enthusiasm.
That's two. All right. This is going to take us to the end of round one for Tara.
Yep.
In the future, every police officer is paired with an android which can cook a close replica of Chinese food, but not quite.
Almost Hunan.
Almost Hunan. Correct. And that brings us to a first score break.
This could scarcely be a closer game. Sarah and I are tied with 10 points each. Mark has 11.
All right. Mark leading the pack. It's a long game. We're running along in the episode, so we're going to skip the Equalizer Challenge Zone this week. Get right back there into it with round two, adding a letter. Adding a letter.
Adding a letter.
All right.
Adding.
It will be an extra letter.
It will Got be it. An extra letter now to Sarah. This reality show follows a group of married princesses who make catty comments behind each other's backs.
Married princesses?
Yes. And I'm going to give you a little extra hint because technically the answer isn't, it's a franchise rather than a single title.
Is this the Regal Housewives?
It's the Regal Housewives, correct. Mark Lazanti. This Edwardian drama chronicles the social upheaval created when a monastery opens near City Hall.
Mm.
This Edwardian drama chronicles the social upheaval created when a monastery opens near City Hall. Don't forget, you can ask for the hint.
Give me a hint.
Hugh Bonneville.
Oh, okay. Downtown Abbey.
Downtown Abbey.
Yeah.
What we all thought it was called the first time we heard
Which is the actual title of the show.
Yep.
Tar-Ariana.
Always type it.
That every time.
Teams compete to match the most popular answers from a survey of 100 psychoanalysts.
Oh, shit. Family Freud. Guys, we're all tied up.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting, this one's from Picky to you. A man uses his talking car to fight crime while working as a reporter at a major newspaper conglomerate.
Oh, Knight Ridder.
Love it.
Good for two. Mark. Hilarious consequences ensue when an officer in the Marines tries to balance his work, his family, and the fact that he is a zombie.
Major dead.
Back to Tara. A Wisconsin man teaches his European cousin about American culture as they commit a series of murders.
Perfect Stranglers.
Dark.
Oh.
Sarah, this is everybody's last question on round two, starting with Sarah. A junk dealer is constantly at odds with his father, the founder of a prestigious university.
Stanford and Son?
All right, this might be my favorite one of the game for Mark. Two FBI... I rewrote this one, so apologies to Raven if he doesn't quite recognize this one. I rewrote a little bit. Two FBI agents investigate paranormal phenomena involving boneless cuts of meat.
The X-Filets.
And our last question of round two for Tara. Contestants receive a prize of moderate value and have the option of exchanging it for a mysterious sticker.
What?
Contestants receive a prize of moderate value and have the option of exchanging it for a mysterious sticker.
I need a hint.
Monty Hall.
Let's make a decal.
Let's make a decal go for 1 point. And that takes us into our second score break.
Still very close. I have 15 points. Now Sarah and Mark are tied with 16 each.
All right. Now everybody has 3 questions left. So 6 points available to everybody here.
Okay.
And we do have a tiebreaker if it comes to that. All right. Round 3, taking away a letter. Okay.
Oh God.
Yes.
Starting with Sarah. Harder. A mystery writer struggles with the injustice inherent in the class system as he works with a female detective to solve crimes.
Cast?
Cast from Castle, correct. Mark.
Oh.
Each week, a different superstitious event creates conflict within a team of female interior decorators. Each week.
One more time.
Each week, a different superstitious event creates conflict within a team of female interior decorators. Shoot the moon or ask for a hint?
It's denying. No, that's not right. Give me. I know the show. I'm trying to take one away.
I'll read it one more time for you. Each week, a different superstitious event creates conflict within a team of female interior decorators. What's that show?
Designing Omen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tatara.
Yep.
An organization of British noblemen keeps the peace in a world filled with superheroes.
And?
Clark Gregg. An organization of British noblemen keeps the peace in a world filled with superheroes. Take away one letter.
I know.
Steel meal.
Go ahead. Go for it. All I have no idea.
Okay. I didn't know if I jumped too soon.
Go ahead.
No, it's fine. I don't know.
Gents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Gents of
S.H.I.E.L.D. Damn it!
Correct. All right. This is a good one for Sarah.
I apologize if I jumped in
too
soon.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
For Sarah, a former White House communications director runs a crisis management firm while wearing a single open-toed shoe.
Sandal.
Of course.
You're out of steel meals, by the way, Mark. I should have said that before. Okay. Now you are.
Oh,
out.
Thank you.
Mark, a New York doctor relocates to Alabama and takes up painting.
Art of Dixie.
Art of Dixie, correct. Tara, in this mystery thriller, four friends try to unravel the disappearance of the adorable young lead drummer of Metallica. Which really hinges on your knowledge of guys in Metallica, I guess.
Nope, I don't know. So hint, please.
Ashley Benson. Is it Benson? Partly.
Pretty Little Lars.
Pretty Little Lars is correct for 1 point. All right, everybody's last question coming up. So quickly, the scores.
Oh, boy, you guys. Okay, I have 16 points. Sarah has 20 points. Mark has 21.
All right.
Oh, boy. No pressure.
Boy, oh, boy. All right. Put on your thinking caps. Here comes everybody's last question of regulation, starting with Sarah. Former contestants from a dating show think they're getting a second chance at love, but actually the footage is just going to be used to promote the show they were kicked out of.
What? I'm sorry. Could you read it again, please?
Former contestants from a dating show think they're getting a second chance at love, but actually the footage is just going to be used to promote the show they were kicked out of.
Kicked out of. They were kicked out. Shit. Oh my god.
Any idea? So talk obvious. It out. Sometimes it helps.
A dating show. Well, I don't think it's The Bachelor or The Bachelorette because you can't really subtract any letters from that and have it make any sense. So, what else is there? Temptation Island. That makes no sense. I keep thinking of The Match Game or The Love Connection. I don't know. I need a hint.
Chris Harrison.
God damn it.
All right, I'm calling this one.
Yeah, you got to do it.
All right. Anybody else? Nobody has steel meals, but can anybody guess what it is?
I assume it's Bachelor in Paradise, but I don't know how that would work either.
Nope. Huh. It's Bachelor Ad. Bachelor
Ad. Oh, Bachelor Pad.
Oh. Oh, wow.
That thing.
All right. That's Mark, here's your chance. Two brilliant but socially awkward physics nerds have an idea on how to carry all your purchases after a huge shopping spree.
The Big Bag Theory.
Big Bag Theory, of course. All right, last question of the game for Tara. An eclectic group of cab drivers. This is a good one. An eclectic group of cab drivers struggle to fill out their 1040.
Tax.
Do you say 1040 or 104?
Yeah, 1040.
Yeah, 1040. 2 points. All right, final scores, please, Tara.
Dang.
That was really fun. I ended with 18 points. Sarah had 20. Mark wins with 23.
Well, 23.
Good job, Mark.
Thank you. Wow, my head hurts.
Well, it's not quite over yet. We have a tiebreaker that we're going to now use to see who can get a steel meal by guessing the correct answer first. I will read the whole description. This is a change of letter. First person to answer wins a steel meal. Mark, you're playing for future value guess. Here we go. Does 1+1 really equal 2? This team of intrepid investigators blows up stuff to find out if the rumors are true.
Mathbusters.
Mathbusters. And that is a steel meal for value guess.
Valued guest.
Well done, Mark. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Done across the board today.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We gobbled up Homecoming's offerings, then... Remember...
We're listening.
I am David Teagle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
I know.
Sarah D. Bunting.
When did you get microwaves back?
And Mark Lazanti. Thanks for listening. Mark died. And we'll see you next week, right here.
Goodbye.
On Extra Hot Great.
Who's the bird?
Without TV, you really notice how long every second is.